Justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on the show, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook speaks to Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the women-led peace group Code Pink. Code Pink is a grassroots NGO with an anti-war mandate. The Russian invasion of Ukraine began on the morning of February 24, 2022, which makes today the one-year anniversary. Today, Seabrook and Benjamin discuss the global efforts Code Pink and like-minded organizations have made to encourage a peaceful resolution to this war. Named as a high-profile leader in the peace movement by the Los Angeles Times, Medea Benjamin is the co-founder of Code Pink and co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange. Benjamin has been an advocate for social justice for more than 40 years, and she is also an author. Her latest book is War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict, co-written by Nicholas J.S. Davies. Here are Seabrook and Benjamin in conversation. Take a listen.
Thank you again, Medea Benjamin, for joining me here today. Medea, you're from Code Pink, a women-led peace activist group. We're talking today, this week, which is the anniversary of the beginning of the war in Ukraine. What are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling heartbroken that so many people have died, that there have been millions of refugees. When you look at the destruction, the rubble, the houses that have been demolished, the hospitals, the infrastructure, and you just think of how senseless this whole thing is, all of these precious lives wasted in what could have been avoided, I just feel like the human community has not evolved far enough to recognize that this way of dealing with conflicts is just not only unjust, inhumane, but untenable.
Now, what are some of the initiatives that Code Pink has undertaken over the past year to help promote peace in Ukraine?
We have tried to educate people that peace talks are possible because there has been this narrative in the mainstream media and from officialdom that you cannot talk to Putin, that the only solution is a victory on the battlefield. And so we have been saying that we condemn Russia's invasion, but we try to show the context in which it happened, how it was provoked by the West, and how the West has an important role to play in finding the solutions to it. And after, in addition to doing educating, we've been mobilizing people. So we've had constant rallies, including one that happened on Sunday, February 19th, in which over 1,000 people showed up. We have been organizing lobby days. We just had one on February 21st. We were in the halls of Congress, about 40 of us, going to all the members of the Armed Services Committees. And we've been encouraging people in their home districts to set up meetings or go directly and have protests in the offices of their Congress people, because the vast majority of them have only been rubber stamping more and more weapons for Ukraine, over $110 billion for Ukraine in the last year. And we have so many needs here in the United States that are unmet. So those are the kinds of things that we have been doing.
Now, you also met with U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Having met with the congressional leadership, are you feeling encouraged? Were they receptive to the message you were sending about peace?
We didn't get to meet with him, but with his chief of staff and other staff people. We were encouraged that they took the time to meet with us and hear us out. We really swarmed their office, and we had people coming from all over the country with very heartfelt statements that they wanted to make to the speaker, telling them that their own communities were suffering from poverty, environmental degradation, all kinds of issues like the train wrecks that we have had recently that require government involvement. And so one of the messages was certainly one that we can't afford this. But the other message that we sent, and I think we managed to get our point across, is that the speaker, Kevin McCarthy, before he became a speaker, said that he was against a blank check for Ukraine. And we wanted to reinforce that position, because once he became speaker, he started to walk that back, because all the pressure that these people get once they're in very important positions. So I think we're a tiny, tiny antidote to the power of that military-industrial congressional complex that likes to keep wars going.
If the war does keep going and the West continues to provide military aid, what are some of the risks that the world faces if this conflict continues?
Well, that's what we were asking. We said, you know, first you told us Patriot missiles and that will solve the problem. Then it was HIMARS. Then it was tanks. Now the discussion is about fighter jets. What next? It will probably be troops. And what comes after that? Well, I think we're really looking at a nuclear war. And we've got to get serious about this. You know, this is so dangerous that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved the doomsday alarm clock to 90 seconds before midnight, saying the world is really at risk of a nuclear Armageddon. And we are walking not with our eyes closed anymore, I think with our eyes open directly into that void. So we've got to make people realize how dangerous this is and how a nuclear war is a real possibility.
Now, public opinion doesn't seem to feel that urgency. This week, Angus Reid in Canada conducted a poll of Canadians, and only 23% of those polled agreed that Ukraine should negotiate with Russia. And almost 40% were willing to continue to provide military aid to Ukraine until they've reclaimed all of their territory, including the Crimea. What does this say about why the public is so willing to take this risk? Is this a failure of government and media?
It shows the real brilliance of this propaganda campaign that we see in the media that has somehow convinced people that this is a fight against of democracy, against authoritarianism, where, you know, we see the, quote, democracies of the world supporting authoritarians from Saudi Arabia to Egypt to Israeli oppressive governments around the world. And we see a total blackout of the issues of NATO expansion, Western intervention and internal affairs in Ukraine, and legitimate Russian security interests that must be taken into account. Here in the United States, we see opinion polls that are actually changing. The AP polls that were taken recently showed that only 48% of Americans want to see continued arms sent to Ukraine. I find that very encouraging, since it went down from 60% a couple of months ago, and because it shows that people are seeing through this media and mainstream narrative and recognizing that sending weapons is only fueling the fire of war instead of finding solutions. Sending weapons is actually a disincentive to Zelensky to sit down at the negotiating table.
Now, since the start of the war, the NATO and the West has imposed heavy sanctions on Russia in an attempt to bring them to the negotiating table. I saw on Code Pink's website that you oppose sanctions on Russia. I was wondering why you oppose the sanctions on Russia, and are they an ineffective tool to try and promote peace?
Yeah, we don't mind sanctions on billionaires or taking of their yachts or their mansions overseas. What we oppose is sanctions that hurt ordinary people. But it's quite interesting in this case of Russia, as opposed to U.S. sanctions on smaller countries, these have backfired. The Russians have been able to stabilize the ruble. While they are selling less oil, they are making plenty of money because the price of oil has increased, and they're also able to sell their oil to countries like China and India. The ones who are really feeling the pinch of the sanctions are the Europeans, who are paying a much higher price for their energy and for their groceries. And that is happening around the world, where especially in places like Africa and the Middle East, there was a tremendous dependence on the grain coming from Ukraine and the fertilizers coming from Russia. And this has really affected the global economy, which is why we hear leaders all over the global South, from South Africa to Indonesia to Brazil, saying, we want you all the parties in this war, to sit down and find a solution. We see President Lula, who is meeting with President Biden recently in the White House, and Biden was encouraging Brazil to send weapons to Ukraine. And he said, we don't want to join this war. We want to end this war.
You mentioned earlier how Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, has been characterized as, you know, the modern day Hitler gobbling up his neighbors. What does peace look like? How do we encourage Putin to come to the table? And what do you think his intentions truly are? Is he really the threat that he's being made out to be?
Well, if his intentions were to take over all of Ukraine, certainly he was not able to do that. And now the fighting has become limited to the areas mostly of the Donbas, and the discussion over what happens in Crimea. I think these are issues that can be dealt with. And in fact, we saw a 15-point peace plan that was being discussed just a month after the invasion that included Russian troops out and neutrality for Ukraine. But these peace talks were scuttled by the West. We heard that Boris Johnson came in to say that the West does not want an agreement with Russia, but it will give Ukraine the support it needs for victory. We heard Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense from the United States, come in and saying that we have to use this moment to weaken Russia. And we even have not only officials from Turkey who were involved in those discussions, and officials in Ukraine itself saying that the West scuttled these talks, but we have former Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, who was involved in talks as well, who said that the West blocked those talks. So we have to make sure that our countries are not blocking negotiations, that our countries are actually pushing Zelensky to the negotiating table. And in the case of the United States, I think we need direct talks between the United States and Russia on all of these arms agreements, the last of which the Russians just pulled out of the New START treaty. We need discussions about what will it take for the West to lift the sanctions on Russia. And we need discussions about the provocations like U.S. bases that are very, very close to Russia's border in countries like Romania and Poland.
Now, you mentioned that figures in the West, like Boris Johnson, like Lloyd Austin, had worked to undermine, actually, the peace process. And I wanted to ask you, in your opinion, why is that? Who's benefiting from a weaker Russia? Who's benefiting from this war continuing?
Well, there is the smaller answer to that, which is that there are economic benefits for the weapons industry as well as for the energy companies, like the ones in the U.S. that have stepped in to replace the energy that used to come from Russia. But there are bigger issues, and that is the strategic issues that both the U.S. and NATO have said, that China is the main adversary of the West, and that weakening Russia so that it will not be able to be an important ally to China is part of these larger geostrategic interests. I think we're seeing a new alignment where the U.S. has been trying to make sure that Europe is solely part of the West and the U.S. orbit and not integrated into Russia and Asia. And the powers that be in the United States are seeing this as a way to strengthen the U.S. hand in its what many could see as a coming conflict with China. We find this extremely dangerous. It's bad enough that we are at war with Russia right now, but imagine being in a war with China. So that's why we think it's so important to stop this war and deter our leaders from thinking that they can deal with conflicts with China in a militaristic way instead of through areas of diplomacy.
Are you hopeful that we could move off of that track of antagonism with China and Russia? And do you think that the war will end this year, or do you think we'll be marking another anniversary a year from now?
It's so hard to say. My optimism is this pressure that's coming from the global community, particularly from Europe and the global South. We are in touch with our colleagues in Europe who are organizing many big demonstrations for this year, marking the one anniversary since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. There is a new coalition called Europe for Peace that is gaining a lot of momentum. And we think that the efforts of the Chinese, who are about to announce a peace plan, are very positive, because that means that they have been talking to the Russians and pushing Putin to be more amenable towards negotiations. And I really do feel positive and inspired by the words of people like Lula, who say we don't need to send more weapons. We need interlocutors to tell the Russians what a mistake they made and tell the Ukrainians how urgent it is that they go for peace talks.
In terms of peace, if there is peace between Russia and Ukraine, what would that look like? And is the dismantling of NATO, would that be a major part of what a future peace and more stable world could look like?
I don't see that happening in the short or medium term, but I do see it happening in the long term, because I think a lesson that really is just starting to sink in for the Europeans is that hitching their wagon directly to the United States has not been good for them, that they need to have their own security architecture, they need to have their own foreign policy, and they need to have independence from the United States. I also see that the global community is much more intensely looking at ways to get around the U.S. dollar. For example, the ways that countries are now buying oil in local currencies instead of dollars, trying to find ways to get around the SWIFT international financial exchange, and how the grouping of countries called the BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, there are now many other countries that want to join that, again, as an alternative to the almighty dollar. I think these kinds of changes are actually positive in the long run, and we will be seeing a lot of that as we move forward, because I think as Russia has overplayed its hand in thinking perhaps that it could take over Ukraine, so the U.S. has overplayed its hand in thinking that it could solve this problem purely by sending more and more weapons and fighting this to the last Ukrainian.
Now, Canada is also sending weapons to Ukraine. We've sent two tanks. We promised two more. What can Canadian activists do here in this country to help encourage peace?
I have been shocked by the position of Canada and what seems to me the lack of people both in political positions, like in the PRD, coming out for negotiations and opposing the sending of weapons. And as far as I see, I don't see a lot of big demonstrations happening in Canada against the Canadian government position. So I'm very perplexed at why Canadians seem to be willing to do what Europe is doing, which is to hitch their wagon to the militarist stance of the United States. I hope that that will change in the coming months as it becomes clear to Canadians, just as it's becoming clear to people all over the world, that global inflation that is partly generated by this war is bad for us, and that all Canadians who care about the planet and are concerned about climate issues will see this war as part of a devastation of the climate, not only for what it's doing to devastate the resources in Ukraine itself, and what the increase in weapons production and use does to the climate, but also the huge amount of resources and energy that is going into the destruction of the climate instead of preserving the climate. All of the money that all of our countries, well, the 40 Western countries are using to support Ukraine, and of course, all the money that the Russians are using to destroy Ukraine needs to be spent on preserving the planet.
What are some upcoming events or initiatives that Code Pink is undertaking to continue to promote peace?
We are calling on women and their allies all over the world to use March 8th, International Women's Day, as a time to stand up for peace. We are also organizing demonstration here in Washington, D.C., where I am, on March 18th. We are working with our allies in Europe, calling for gatherings in a neutral country in Austria in the spring. We are engaged in all kinds of efforts to show the global opposition to this war, including an urgent global call that will be coming out, initiated by our friends in Europe and the Global South. So we're involved in all of these initiatives, and we hope that it will start snowballing, because we really need this groundswell from the bottom up to convince our, quote, leaders of how bad their leadership has been.
Medea Benjamin, thank you very much for sharing Code Pink's message of peace and your work on this issue with us here at Rabble and our listeners.
Thank you so much for having me on. Good talking to you.
That was Rabble editor Nick Seabrook and Medea Benjamin in conversation. Thanks so much for joining us, Medea. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, we'll hand it back over to Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg shared his analysis of the Rouleau Commission report on the federal government's use of the Emergencies Act last February. The Trudeau Liberal government used the Emergencies Act last year for the first time in the nation's history to clear the convoy occupation that paralyzed Ottawa's downtown and other parts of Canada in early 2022. Justice Paul Rouleau conducted an independent inquiry into the use of the Act and found the government was justified in using this extraordinary piece of legislation. Rouleau's report states that police services quickly became overwhelmed by the occupation and were unable to enforce even basic bylaws around parking and excessive noise. Nirenberg writes, quote, "In addition, Rouleau mentioned the convoyers' intimidation of tow truck drivers, the fact that the residents of besieged Coutts, Alberta, near the U.S. border, were unable to travel to get food and medicines, and the presence of children at many protest sites," end quote. In labor news, nursing and care workers employed by Calgary, Alberta's CareWest public health care provider are fighting for better wages and job security. Rabble's Journalism for Change fellow Kia Lucero reports that CareWest had offered its employees a pay increase of just 1% in 2021 and is offering a 1.25% increase in 2023. Additionally, CareWest was seeking to impose a contract that would allow them to enforce mandatory overtime, sometimes without overtime pay, as well as the ability to change scheduled paid time off and restrict a worker's ability to file grievances. The Alberta Union of Provincial Employees, who represents the workers, say that CareWest is treating their members with contempt. These frontline workers are as determined as ever to get a fair contract from CareWest, but the employer continues to treat them with contempt by demanding concessions in bargaining, reads a statement from Bobby Joe Barodi, who is the union's vice president. In environmental news, and as part of Rabble's activist toolkit, Rabble national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel shared how a grassroots activist group is working to protect Vancouver's urban forests. Wondrous Tree Fellowship is seeking to raise awareness about challenges facing urban forests, including increased development, population pressures, and effects of a rapidly changing climate. In a press release, the group states, quote, "A healthy urban forest provides valuable ecological services, mitigates effects of climate change, and is integral to our physical and mental health," end quote. The Wondrous Tree Fellowship will be holding the Tri-Cities Urban Forest Forum on Tuesday, March 7th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Douglas College in Vancouver. And finally, as Rabble continues to observe Black History Month,
A student at Carleton University shared a story on a new course on Black journalism being taught by former Ottawa journalist Adrian Harewood. The course chronicles the history of Black journalism in Canada, as well as its future, and how Black storytellers ensured that their narrative would find a voice. The course was announced in the summer of 2022, but was in development long before that. The course came about thanks to grassroots activism in the wake of the murder of George Floyd in the summer of 2020. BIPOC alumni from the school issued a call-to-action letter demanding that Carleton improve their approach to equity and diversity. Harewood has personally felt supported in his efforts to develop education about racialized journalism at the school. However, there remain some fundamental problems within the journalism school, including among students, that need to be addressed. Harewood said, quote, "We all need to be willing to interrogate ourselves in a very rigorous way. There is a lot of work that needs to be done. There still needs to be uncomfortable conversations about race," end quote. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. Lastly, a word from our first Rabble Rouser to watch of 2023, Matthew Martin.
Hi, I'm Matthew Martin from Black Lives Matter New Brunswick. Black Lives Matter New Brunswick serves to dismantle systemic racism and to empower our Black communities. I am humbled to be named one of the Rabble Rousers to watch for 2023, and I'd like to thank the readers for nominating me. To learn more about the work that we do, check out my interview at rabble.ca.
And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
En mars, ce qui veut dire que les célébrations entourant le 25e anniversaire des rendez-vous de la francophonie sont en cours. Dès maintenant, visitez le rvf.ca pour voir ce que les rendez-vous vous ont préparé.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia. broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples. Find us online at cjsf.ca and on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.
Radio Rewind.